It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In just a bit, we'll look at the influence of reality television and celebrity culture on the American dream. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, we look at the role of technology in the classroom.
President Obama is pursuing a plan that would expand high-speed internet access in schools. The goal? Students could use digital notebooks. Teachers could customize lessons with online technology.
Administration officials say the plan would create a new educational ecosystem and better prepare kids for the future. But others worry that added technology could take away from learning time or, in some cases, become the sole source of learning in the classroom.
Joining us now to discuss technology in the classroom is Michelle Davis, senior writer at Education Week Digital Directions. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, this is a big moving target, kind of, but today, what do you see as the role of technology in classrooms?
Well, I think at this point, it's really short-sighted not to embrace technology in schools and in classrooms. I mean, students are using this in their daily life outside of school for entertainment and for social networking. They're going to have to use it in college and certainly in the workplace. So to not embrace what technology can do just seems short-sighted.
So as the White House is calling for more technology investment in the classrooms, what are some of the concrete things that you're seeing on the cutting edge that maybe you're excited about?
Well, there's definitely a lot of programs, one-to-one technology programs where schools are using tablets, iPads, all kinds of things to do very interesting things with students that involve personalized learning, that involve video, all kinds of project-based learning, things like that. And also, you know, the Common Core is coming up, and it requires online testing of students. And schools are going to need an enhanced broadband capabilities to be able to do that online.
But there's a critique, you know, that math is math, reading's reading. We're just jazzing it up with all sorts of bells and whistles. That's maybe ultimately a distraction from learning the stuff we're supposed to be teaching.
Well, I do think that educators need to be a little bit wary of jumping on the bandwagon to, you know, looking at whatever is the latest and greatest technology, the latest and greatest program. And it's not about sitting a kid in front of a computer and putting them in front of a program and never checking on them again. What studies have shown in terms of technology and education is that what really works best is a blended learning situation in which teachers are interacting with students, but students are also interacting with the technology. So, you know, there can be a negative effect if a student is just placed in front of a computer and you know, told to work completely independently.
And how are schools dealing with the cost issue? A lot of the stuff we're talking about isn't cheap. Is there kind of a technology gap out there in schools?
There's definitely a technology gap. The current E-Rate program, which funds a lot of broadband connections and internet connections, is way oversubscribed. There were about $5 million in requests for broadband funding last year, and I think the program has about half of that available. So there's definitely a gap there, and there are definitely schools that can't afford to have strong broadband connections, which this program seeks to provide. And those weak connections don't allow you to stream video, have a lot of students working on computers or tablets at the same time. So even if you have an internet connection, if it's a slow one, there's really not a lot you can do with it.
Now, President Obama's plan would involve having a tax on mobile phones to pay for this technology. That's probably a whole nother discussion and a political roadblock there. But from what you've seen about this, do you think that their plan would really help cover that gap?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm not sure anyone knows the answer to that right now. Definitely, as I said, there's a lot of requests for funding out there that are not being funded right now. And certainly, as I mentioned, with the Common Core coming along, there's a greater need for that than ever. So, you know, at least it's a step towards trying to cover that gap.
Now, schools are big, and there are lots of them, and it's hard to, you know, keep up with the times sometimes. Is there a risk that, you know, a school system embraces the technology that's cutting edge today only to find it's obsolete for the next incoming class?
I think that is a risk, particularly when schools are focused on the technology and not the goal of what they want to do with the technology. I've definitely seen some programs, some schools that say, oh, here's an iPad. That's the latest and greatest thing. We want to use that. But they're really not sure what they want to accomplish educationally with that technology. I think the most successful programs are the ones that think about their goals first, and it's sort of technology agnostic. It's not based on the newest technology or whatever is popular and hot now. It's based on what gets them to their educational goals.
In practice, do you see school systems making that right decision, making the technology the servant of the educational goal and not making the educational goal conform to the available technology?
I do see that more and more. It's certainly something that I think is growing, and people are becoming more informed. But you know, it's a slow situation. Schools are very slow to move in terms of their procurement plans, in terms of change and adapting. And so it's definitely a slow process, even with training teachers. That's definitely a slow process.
I wanted to ask about teacher training. Teachers have to, they learn how to manage classrooms. They learn the topics they're teaching. Now there's another layer, learning the technology that they're working with. How big a challenge is that?
I think it's a big challenge. There was a study that came out last year that found really in teachers' colleges that the type of training, technology training teachers are receiving is really just one course when really it should be integrated, the technology should be integrated throughout their training courses. So I think that is a hurdle, and they're also finding that new teachers are just as likely as veteran teachers to incorporate technology into their classrooms, which is kind of surprising since the newer teachers are generally digital natives. So I think there's a real gap out there in terms of teacher training. Some programs are realizing that in order for some of these initiatives, like one-to-one initiatives, to be successful, they really have to lay the groundwork with professional development and training ahead of time.
Is there a worry that a lot of classrooms, I mean, it's like, you know, the old film projectors that seemed to break all the time when I was a kid. Are we going to see a lot of time wasted in class trying to get, you know, the printer to work, the computer to work, the internet connection, the modem, or whatever they use instead of modems these days, up and running?
Well, I do think a lot of times the students are able to help with that more than the teachers. But I also think, you know, going back to the president's proposal, this goes back to sort of how strong your connection is and how fast your connection is. When you're trying to stream a video and you have a slow connection and it has to reload every 5 minutes, you know, that's really disruptive to a teacher's lesson, and it's really irritating for a student who's trying to learn. So having this broadband connection is really significant.
I remember as a kid, my mom was a teacher, and when she got the first, what was it, a PET computer, it was one of those 64-bit computers like the TRS-80, and you could do little spelling programs on it. It's amazing how far we've come since then. What are you looking at that maybe isn't even in classrooms yet but is on the horizon? What's the near-term science fiction of the classroom looking like to you?
Oh, well, I've just recently wrote a story about coding, computer coding for students, and I think that's becoming a real trend. And I've been talking with people who are viewing computer coding as sort of a new language that needs to really be incorporated into schools the way reading and math are today, that it's sort of the language of the future, and that even students as young as kindergarten and elementary school should be learning the building blocks of computer coding to set them up for the careers of the future. So I think there's going to be a push on that front.
That's really interesting, because I've seen over the years complaints that kids weren't learning coding. There weren't easy languages like BASIC and things like that out there. How are they in this day and age having simple enough programs that kids can take the first step?
Oh, well, there's a lot of programs out there, Scratch, Alice. And the way that a lot of teachers and programmers are getting kids interested is through video gaming. So you sort of set the hook and say, okay, I'm going to teach you some basic coding practices so that you can build your own video game. And students are really intrigued by that and really interested in that. And once they understand some of the basics through these programs, then they can move on to the more difficult languages. But that's really the video gaming piece seems to be the hook.
Before we're done, I'm getting the sense that you're kind of excited about the opportunities out there of integrating technology into our classrooms.
Well, that's what I write about, so I'm pretty interested in it. But, you know, I do think there are things that educators need to be careful about, as we've mentioned. But there's a lot of possibilities out there. And the people who are doing it right and doing it in a sort of thoughtful manner are really doing some creative things.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Michelle Davis. She's senior writer for Education Week Digital Directions.
Coming up next, we'll look at the influence of reality television and celebrity culture on the American dream. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Noah. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
2 weeks ago, in an interview with Amazon.com, President Obama suggested that reality television and celebrity culture, that's the phrase, have changed the aspirations of young people.
He suggested that the American dream used to be about more basic things like a good job, a good education, and health care. But reality TV shows are changing that. And now kids want the fancy 10,000 square foot houses they see at the reality stars like the Kardashians living in.
He went on to say that in the past, quoting here, kids weren't monitoring every day what Kim Kardashian was wearing or where Kanye West was going on vacation and thinking that somehow was the mark of success.
We'll be taking your calls during this segment. Let us know what you think of reality TV and celebrity culture, whether or not it's changed the aspirations of young people today. Is the president right to be worried about it? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org.
Prachi Gupta is with us. She's assistant news editor at Salon. Prachi, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So what do you think President Obama's getting at with these comments, the worries he expressed there?
Well, I think what he's talking about is, you know, the kind of circus that we see on reality TV and how it's not a reflection of real life. But I actually, I'm not a huge fan of reality TV, but I actually don't quite agree with his assessment. I think it's really tempting to blame reality TV for, you know, because it's a kind of a circus. But I think, look, this is the first generation for whom college doesn't guarantee a job. And we're predicted to not outperform the generation before us, where, you know, students are already facing going in with massive debt. I think those actually are, the economy is way more of a contributing factor to a shift in the perspective of the American dream, and was way more to blame than reality TV ever could be. I don't think college students or students facing this kind of debt are really having intense dreams about owning a 10,000 square foot house. I think they're wondering, how am I going to pay for college, and is it even worth it anymore? Which is not a question that was around, you know, even 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, nevertheless, the Kardashians are certainly a popular family to follow, and it's a popular program. So are you saying that you don't see viewers embracing the culture in the way of, you know, going out to the store and maybe over-consuming, or do you think that it's just sort of escapism?
Sure. I mean, I think that's kind of an age-old question with TV. You know, do we imitate the media, or does media reflect what we really are? And it's just sort of a funhouse mirror relationship there. But I guess I do see it more as escapism. I think that, I mean, I'm not advocating reality TV by any means, but I think it reflects a sort of extremism in America that didn't necessarily exist even 30 years ago. And I think people like Kim Kardashian are more of a symptom of that reality than the cause of it.
Do you think there's just this is kind of like a crabby sort of these kids today with their reality TV and their Kanye West line of clothing and by the way, stay off my White House lawn sort of mentality? Do you think that might be where this is coming from?
I'm not sure that I don't think I know anybody who's looking up to Kim Kardashian and saying, oh, I really want to emulate her. I'm not sure that that's a realistic ideal for a lot of teenagers. I think she gets a lot of bad press for due reason, and I think people kind of see her as a spectacle.
Do you have a sense of whether or not, though, this was, President Obama alleges that this wasn't what American culture was like maybe 40, 50 years ago, but they still had Marilyn Monroe and other lavish celebrities to kind of keep an eye on, maybe not with as much, prevalence as we do today on our cable networks and all that. But what's your take on it? Do you think that there has been a shift over the last 50 years, or is it pretty much the same, just a different media landscape?
I think there definitely has been a shift. I mean, we've always had sort of this obsession with the rich and the wealthy. I mean, there was a show called Lifestyles of the Rich and the Famous several years ago, and reality TV has been around for actually, more than 20 years. But I think what President Obama was getting at was the whole phenomena of famous for being famous, which that is a relatively new phenomena. The idea that you can be a celebrity without necessarily having a particular skill set or talent that elevates you above everybody else. And I think that's why people like Kim Kardashian get such a are so easy to hate, because they're famous simply for being famous. And that's definitely a phenomena of, I think, partially the internet culture. But I think the flip side to that is also that the internet has given us a way out too. There's a way to make it in America that generations before didn't have. One viral video can put you on the map and change your life. That's not something that existed, obviously, 20 years ago. And I think that that needs to factor into the vision of the American dream, because that's certainly something that people see, kids growing up today see that and aspire to that.
Well, that's interesting, and that might speak to a little of what President Obama was talking about, this idea that not necessarily get rich quick, but get famous quick by making our break on American Idol, getting our internet video out there, as you mentioned, being famous for being famous. And he seems to be saying this is a distraction from hard work, gumption, grit, and gusto that we would have looked at as the recipe for success back in the day.
Sure, yeah. I do think that that's kind of what he's getting at. But as I mentioned earlier, I think the problem is that you're looking at 20-something teenagers now who are growing up in a really unstable economy, who don't see hard work equating to getting a job and being financially successful anymore. So they're kind of grasping at straws, figuring out, well, okay, how do I establish that? How do I get to that level of success? And this is a way out that didn't exist 30 years ago. And I'm not sure that it's really a viable solution, but I think a lot of kids growing up are now seeing it as a way to make it in America. That I think his comments mean, yeah, this is not a realistic solution. But it is something that, and it is something that didn't exist. But I think the flip side to that is the internet is a powerful tool. I think there's a saying that the internet can make smart people smarter and dumb people dumber. And I think that's very true. I think that's true with TV as well. There's a lot of great stuff on TV. There's a lot of great stuff on the internet. But it's all about, education and learning how to use the internet and learning how to use TV to improve ourselves and to reach that level of talent and ability.
Your point that a lot of people are seeing this lack of opportunity, it's new for a lot of America, but a lot of people have been there all along in low-income areas, in urban areas, in rural areas. They may not have seen that road to success for a long time now. Is this something that's been with us for a long time for parts of the population? The rest of us are just starting to see that bad news?
I think that's definitely true. I think that, yeah, I would agree with that. I also think I mentioned earlier that we've become a country of extremes in a way that we never were before. 1% of the population owns 40% of the wealth, and that's unprecedented. So I think that it's a magnified, the problem has been magnified. We no longer have this really mobile class structure. So I think a larger percentage of the population is now faced with this like shifted American dream than 50 years ago.
We're talking to Prachi Gupta. She's assistant news editor for Salon, the web magazine. We're talking about our starting point was President Obama's comments about reality TV and celebrity culture, giving a weird message about what the American dream is and sending a weird message about material culture, what we need to look successful. Also talking about whether the traditional roads to success are still there. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Celebrity culture, reality TV, sending a weird message. President Obama right or wrong about this? You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert. We're talking about reality TV, celebrity culture, and the messages that they send about material success.
Prachi Gupta is with us, assistant news editor at Salon. We'll get to your calls at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Do you think reality TV is changing the way we think about success, about the stuff we should have? Again, 800-642-1234 is the number. And we'll go to the phones now. We've got Brian with us in Cedar Rapids. Hi there, Brian.
Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I'll be the first one to jump on the bandwagon about bashing reality TV. But in this case, because I'm not a big fan, but one thing I have noticed about it and what I think it's good is it may give some kids a skewed version of what success is. That's true. But I think our kids are smarter than we give them credit for sometimes. I think what reality TV is doing for kids on the positive side is it is exposing them to such a wide variety of careers that I'm 44 years old, and when I was growing up, we did not see all the different, I mean, if you take the car shows where they've got car brokers and dealers. I mean, I just assumed it was car salesmen and guys who made cars. You know, now we've got brokers and, you know, shows like Pawn Stars where you've got, you know, artifacts, antiques representatives, and even shows like America's Got Talent where kids are getting exposure to opera singers and jugglers and all these wonderful choices of things to do that, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we didn't get that much exposure to so many different careers. So although I don't agree with some of the shows and I think that they do get carried away, it is at its core, I do think kids are learning something from it. And I think our kids are smarter than to think that everybody's going to be living like the Kardashians.
Gotcha. Brian, thanks for the call. Prachi, what do you think of first his point that our kids are smarter than that and they won't take a one-to-one lesson from everything they see?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point, and I completely agree with his comment. I think even I when I'm watching reality TV shows, I'm constantly surprised by the types of industries and inside views that you get with the professions and the types of people. And I think that's a really valid point. And I do think that kids are smarter than that.
Let's go next to Fairchild, and Shirley is on the line. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, what's your comment?
I tend to agree, although I do agree with a different perspective that the last caller had made, but I do believe it's very hypocritical of the president to say this because of all of the celebrities that he courts at the White House. For instance, golfing with Tiger Woods in the inaugural ball. He had all of the celebrities there, and he is always having celebrities come in. And for him to say that this is skewing youth, he definitely is leading in the wrong direction, I believe.
What do you think of that? Prachi.
I think I can definitely see the criticism there. I think his comment was more directed specifically towards reality TV and the comments, or rather the whole phenomenon of being famous for being famous. But I do also think that there's validity in his criticizing his observation that everyone's dreaming to have a 10,000 square foot house. I think the commenter has a valid point in saying, you know, if President Obama, like, as a politician, that's part of his job is going to be spending time with celebrities and trying to get fundraising through them. I mean, that's an obvious source for his campaign, and they do affect policy. But I do think that if you're going to criticize people for wanting those things, you do have to take into account that what the commenter said.
All right, we'll go to Anna in Madison next. Anna, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate your guest comments, especially her more pointed comments about the economy being a reality check to the president's comments. And I think Kim Kardashian in general is sort of just the dog on the end of the tail here. And obviously, we're really avoiding having a greater discussion. I'm a millennial digital native, if you will. So I think that people in my generation, I know I went to a Seven Sisters college, and when I was going to school, I was promised a lot of things. And I graduated right basically at the time when the economy was taking a tank, and most of my friends are underemployed. And I don't know anyone in my peer group who is looking at Kim Kardashian as sort of this shining beacon of exemplary behavior. And I think that perhaps maybe we're just looking at her as a socialite. And I think that we had socialites in the past and in our history. And, you know, I think that maybe just being famous for being famous really isn't something that's new. It's really an old trend that we've seen. And look at the royal family. We've seen a huge following for that as well. And also, I'm not to be too long-winded, but the 2013 Edelman Trust Report came out in January and said that basically the people we trust the most are not government leaders or CEOs. They're actually our peers. So I was just wondering if your guest has heard anything about that report and if maybe she could talk a little bit about the way that we're communicating and how this is just deterring from the real factor.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Anna. Brought up a lot of good points. Let's start with that last one, Prachi. Are the millennials, like Anna is saying, not so much worried about the president or the pop culture celebrities? They're worried about their peer group.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, I mean, I'm actually not super well-versed on that study, but I have seen other studies that essentially say that that's kind of the push behind social media and what organizations like BuzzFeed are doing. They've realized that a lot of us get our news from, for example, like from Facebook, what our friends are sharing, and that's what we're talking about, and that's what the conversations that we're trying to participate in. That's also why we share things on social media. Part of it is how we want to perceive, how we want others to perceive us within our peer groups. So I think she's spot on. I think that President Obama's comment is overestimating the influence, the type of influence that figures like Kim Kardashian have. And I think she's right in saying that we've always sort of been kind of obsessed with these figures in the media and may now have maybe an extended platform to do so. But that doesn't, I agree that I don't think that on a daily basis that has a huge impact on the decisions that we're making. I also think that a lot of these shows, a lot of the reasons they're so popular is a lot of people like to hate watch them. I mean, there's a phenomenon of just liking to watch the show because she, you know, family, and it's designed to seem ridiculous. And a lot of people watch that and almost feel better because they know that money can't buy everything, clearly, when you watch the show and see all the, you know, the dysfunction. So I think I would agree with a lot of everything that she said. I don't think that the show is. People are watching the show and just emulating everything that they see.
Well, and I think I heard Anna coming to the point of saying that this conversation that President Obama is participating in, that others are, is really a distraction. This is not the big deal, that the economic issues that you, Prachi, were talking about earlier are the core thing. Kind of forget about the pop culture stuff and focus on the real thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why I found the comment to be a little bit disingenuous, because it's so easy to shove things off on pop culture and just say, oh, well, that's the real problem. But I think if you look at that, what that means deeper, I mean, pop culture, like I said earlier, it's a funhouse mirror. And I think if you look at the definition of the American dream, or the way he defined it, was having a good job where you felt some security, a good education. People felt if they worked hard, they could get there. Those are things he said that is a direct reflection of if you look at our current economy, that's not the case. And I think that's really what's responsible for people being disillusioned, if they are, with the American dream, not reality TV.
Well, Prachi, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Prachi Gupta, she is the assistant editor, news editor for Salon.
Now we'll check the headlines and then discuss how an increase in human rights laws around the world may not be good for human rights. Our next guest says when it comes to these laws, less can be more. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. Thanks, Noah. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
According to the organization called Freedom House, global respect for basic civil and political rights is in decline for the seventh consecutive year.
And this is going on while the number of international human rights laws has actually gone up.
Our next guest says a rising number of laws could actually be making the protection of human rights more difficult.
In his recent Foreign Affairs article, Jacob Mchangama, director at the Freedom Rights Project and director of legal affairs at the Center for Political Studies, said when it comes to human rights, less can be more. He joins us now from Copenhagen. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So first, you see a lot more and more human rights laws in the world. Where are these all coming from?
Well, they come from different organizations, some of them regional. For instance, here in Europe, we have what is called the Council of Europe, where you have a bunch of human rights conventions. And then, of course, you have the United Nations, where you have a lot of international human rights conventions. And lots of European states, for instance, will be members of both these organizations. And if you take the human rights conventions of the Council of Europe and the UN and add them together, then you have 64 human rights instruments, including some 1,377 provisions, human rights-related provisions. And that reads more like a tax code than a statement of basic principles of the most basic rights. I mean, imagine if the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution included more than 1,000 rights, then I think that would add more confusion rather than clarity as to what inalienable rights Americans enjoyed. And that's basically the same worry that we have at the international level, that all these rights actually add a layer of confusion rather than clarity. And also that some of these rights are actually contradictory. So you have some human rights conventions that protect freedom of expression, but then you have others that actually include an obligation to prohibit certain forms of expression. And how do you reconcile those principles, and how do you make sure that dictatorial states, for instance, don't abuse these provisions?
So looking at, say, a dictatorial state, some kind of oppressive state, does this cloud, this tangle of human rights laws, make it easy for them to find loopholes or be selective or just ignore them altogether because there's just so darn many of them?
Yes. Well, basically, also, if we look at research, there's very little evidence showing that ratifying international human rights conventions actually make a whole lot of difference on the ground. Typically, those states that already respect basic civil liberties are the ones that take their obligations the most seriously, whereas states like, say, Iran or Russia do not take their international human rights obligations particularly seriously. They will perhaps ratify a convention in order to gain some respectability, legitimacy, but but they're not very inclined to take them seriously at home. But what we see, for instance, at the United Nations, at what is called the Human Rights Council, where you have some 47 member states, including countries like Cuba, China, Saudi Arabia, are eligible for membership. You see that countries, for instance, like Cuba, have successfully adopted resolutions on things like the right to peace, the right to development, and other very abstract rights that have very little to do with protecting basic civil liberties that include scrutiny, where you can actually measure whether a state lives up to obligations. And that's, of course, a way to sort of change the whole international rights mechanism, machinery, protection system to serve the interests of rogue states, if you like, and make it into a weapon against Western states, and also sort of defang the whole system. And I think that's a big worry for those of us who actually think that human rights are very worthwhile principles that should be given priority both internationally and nationally.
Well, even apart from those more vague laws or vague ideas and rights you're talking about, even when there are very specific measurable rights, it seems like enforcement is the big problem. If one sovereign nation, even if they've signed on to these treaties, doesn't observe them in action, who can do anything about it?
Yeah, we have to understand that there's no world court of human rights, and I don't know that it would be a good idea or even a workable idea to have a world court of human rights. But I think so we also have to understand, I think, that international human rights conventions cannot, they're not the solution to all instances of repression around the world, but they can serve as one of many tools to help sort of hold states accountable, to empower members of civil society, say, what's going on now in Egypt. You could say, well, there are some pretty clear obligations that you have to live up to, and civil society can use that. U.S. in its foreign policy can look at international standards on religious freedom to try and advance those interests around the world. But obviously, that value, even if it's unlikely to change a dictatorial regime, but the benefits, the limited benefits of international human rights conventions are being diluted when you have 1,377 provisions, and now you have talks about a new convention on for the rights of the elderly and other ideas, because there's simply no clarity, and because the limited focus and resources that international human rights organizations and advocates have are being scattered all over the place. And of course, some states are being able to say, well, okay, we may have some problems when it comes to freedom of expression, but we're doing a whole lot when it comes to the right to development. So you see that, for instance, at the United Nations, where you have something called the Universal Periodic Review. Now, that's basically a human rights exam for all UN member states. And here you can see countries like Cuba and North Korea, perhaps the worst totalitarian state in the world, praising each other for their supposedly progressive social policies. And that obviously flies in the face of what's going on the ground in North Korea, where you have perhaps several hundred thousand people toiling away in modern-day gulags.
Assuming we see guaranteeing some kind of human rights as a positive value, where would you start? How should we define human rights if it's not with this web of over 1,000 laws here?
Yeah, that's a very big question. I mean, one thing is identifying it and saying that there are too many. Another thing is saying what should be the right limit. I would suggest that that people in the human rights movement become more realistic about what is achievable, and I think that focusing first and foremost on basic civil and political rights and principles like the rule of law would be a starting point. Now that's that would be controversial because many would say, well, we also need to focus on other things. But I think that it's the matrix of human rights laws and standards cannot solve every global problem. So I think that issues such as poverty, climate change, and so on are very important problems that the international community should be concerned about. But I'm not convinced that they can be solved through a human rights approach. So this is why we advocate an approach of less is more. So focusing on fewer rights and then an added layer of protection and focus on those rights rather than stretching the whole body of international human rights law across every political international problem without being able to focus on them and without perhaps even the prospect of actually affecting any positive change.
So if the human rights community asked you, all right, Jacob, what are a few of the rights we should put our priority on and really try to focus and get these taken care of? What are a few of those?
No, I would say that something like freedom of expression, association, and assembly that empowers civil society, that allows political pluralism, are absolutely essential. Not only are they morally important, but they're also, instrumental in democratic change. But obviously, also something like the prohibition against torture, and I think we also have to look at what's going on in the West. And no country is a perfect human rights example. And I think that some of the revelations coming out from the U.S. about the role of the NSA and intelligence services in the U.S. but also European states, that's also a human rights issue. So the right to privacy in an age of the war against terror and technological change is also an issue that is human rights relevant.
So you've said all countries have their problems. The United Nations is just a web of conflicting interests. NGOs are overwhelmed. Where does the impetus come from for the kind of change you're looking for?
Well, that's a good question. That's why our small organization has started that. I think that's one of the problems that is seen as politically incorrect to sort of question contemporary mainstream human rights dogma, but I think it's needed. It's very much needed. You have to have a critical look at sort of the ideas that you put out there and sort of the dogmas about contemporary human rights. You have to be able to look at, well, do they actually matter? Do they actually affect change, or do they actually make things worse? But I think obviously liberal democracies have an obligation to try and uphold these principles, because the sort of rights that I would advocate being the focus are the ones that have shown themselves actually to work and to be indispensable for political and individual freedom in liberal democracy. So these are tested rights, and therefore they should be the impetus, and therefore I think that liberal democracies have an obligation to stand up against those states that are spoiler states and that have tried to abuse the human rights system.
All right, and we'll have to leave it there, Jacob. That's Jacob Mchangama, director at the Freedom Rights Project and director of legal affairs at the Center for Political Studies.
Coming up next, our guest says jury trials are on the decline in the United States, and we should be worried about that. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.